Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Clarity, a novel by Keith Thomas. Read by Robin Eller.
One. 10:39 a.m., November 11, 1918, outskirts of Mons, Belgium. The world is a wasteland, and Private George Edwin Ellison is on patrol. Fingers numb, body battered, he pushes his way through a blackened field that was once a schoolyard. The wind is fierce. He pulls up the collar on his jacket to block it out, but it finds the holes, the tears, and worries at his skin, the way the biting gnats did on the rust-colored banks of a nameless Belgian canal. Bites he still scratches. Bites he suspects will never heal. George counts his steps, a time-killing habit, a distraction. Each footfall, a crunch on ruined earth, a solitary beat in the nothingness. Behind the village school building, he finds the charred body of a horse. Its four legs fused with the blackened pile of the school's chimney. Beelzebub's chariot, he thinks, with a chuckle, before moving on. He's seen worse. Smelled worse. Truth is, he's been lucky. It is day 1,566 of the war to end all wars, and he still walks, still has the use of his hands, and the ability to remember home. Not like Richards from A Company. Not like the limbless American he found in an alfalfa field. The war was supposed to be the last spasm of hatred, the last night before a dawn of reason. Only instead of a spasm, it became a cancer. Surely the world couldn't handle another day. As he counts out his steps, George thinks he hears the chanting of the villagers who'd welcomed them in the devastated hamlet, but likely it's just the ceaseless rush of the wind through the naked trees. George rounds the school building and waves the all-clear to the rest of his platoon. As they move toward the canal, he picks up his step. The cold has seeped into his bones, and he recalls fondly how he warmed his fingers beside an oil drum fire that morning. He wishes he could hold that heat like water, rub it like a salve on the numbness overtaking his body. Thinking of the fire conjures up images of home and of his grandmother's butter tarts. He sees his son James, smiling as he waves goodbye in the doorway of their Edmund Street house. And he sees his wife, Hannah, on the night before he'd left. Her cherubic face glowing over their last rationed candle, tears sparkling on her cheeks. George had carved her image on the back of his pocket watch. A smiling, cherubic face done in a simple, amateurish style. Folded and worn, the watch has survived the worst of Ypres, Loos, and Cambrai. A scrap of metal that dodged bullets and survived mortar rounds. George knows that bodies are the weakest link. He's watched so many men die, so many men suffer. Yet, he is still here. Still marching, still counting out steps. Sensing his brief surge in optimism, the exhausted sky breaks open further and lets loose a deluge. George slows, head hung low under the battery of cold rain. Behind him, the platoon follows into formation. The guys who have faith. The ones who believe in something more than mud, fog, rain, and fire. They follow closely. For them, George is the lucky one. Their rabbit's foot. Their dream catcher. He is the one who always keeps walking, pushing forward ceaselessly on automatic, when they all would gladly crumble. 65 feet from the canal, Major Ross halts the 5th Royal Irish Lancers' approach. In the middle of the road, rain spattering their faces, George kneels down in the muck beside Private Frank Price. George points to several cottages across the canal.
"What do you think?"
"Don't like it," Price says. "We're sitting ducks here."
Eyeing the loose bricks on the house's facade, George says,
"Good spot to stick a rifle."
After a minute of watching through the rain and mist, he stands and squeezes Price's shoulder.
I think we should check those houses. Let's get some guys.
With three machine gunners in tow, they cross the bridge. Major Ross yells after them.
Hold there, boys. We'll be across in 5 minutes.
Every step across the bridge is slicker than the last, and the water churns beneath them, festooned with tree limbs, trash, and the bloated bodies of what once were sheep. On the other side, they approach the house carefully, each holding its breath, each as close to George as they can possibly be. Reaching the first house, the machine gunners push their way through a broken door to the dark interior. One of the gunners, Robinson, shouts out a warning.
Ne tirez pas! Ne tirez pas!
Robinson has shouted the phrase in every village, every town. Even though they all knew the French rarely had weapons, it had become Robinson's mantra, his way of staying sane. It works. In the kitchen, they find three elderly Belgian men with broken smiles and blackened hands. George checks the back room while Frank and the gunners talk to the old men. There are Germans near, the old men say, just outside. That's when the roof comes apart. At first, George thinks it's a building collapse. He ducks down, ready for the spine-breaking timbers to hit. But when they don't, when all that falls is a fine mist of brick dust, he knows they are under fire. An angry buzzing comes next as slugs careen around the house, ricocheting off the walls. Dodging bullets, ducking low, George scrambles into the kitchen where the gunners fire through the windows. Frank grabs George's sleeve.
We have to get out of here.
George says,
we need to hold this position till the rest get here.
Frank drags George out a side door and, crouched low, the rain suddenly renewing its attack on their already drenched clothes, they zigzag to a low brick wall at the rear of the house. The narrow cobbled streets look clear, the houses around them empty. George points to a hill 300 feet to the north. There, a German machine gunner reloads his Maschinengewehr. Price says,
I don't think we can take him. We should turn back.
We have 2 minutes to hold here.
George looks down at his pocket watch to see that the hands have stopped. He's confused. He's just recently wound the watch. It should be working. But he is even more confused by the tiny red droplets that lie in a line on the glass surface of the watch. Like red rain, as crimson as blood. The time is stuck at 10:55 a.m. George hears the clatter of gunfire, but it is a world away. Like thunder, a few villages over. It doesn't last long. He turns to see Price hit the muddy earth, a bloom of mud and debris flying overhead. And then George falls backward, only very slowly. The watch in his hand remains as still as its arms. The rain has stopped. The air, thick, heavy like a blanket. A heartbeat later, and George finds himself staring up at the sky. Robinson leans over him with a look of terror. It is 9:29 a.m., and the numbness starts to move across George's body. It crawls from his fingers, up his arms, and from his toes to his thighs. It is not the stinging numbness of the cold, not the impersonal numbness of the rain. It is like falling asleep, like being a child, sinking into a place of enveloping comfort. It is like falling asleep with Hannah in his arms. With that thought, George's breathing slows, and an overwhelming, almost suffocating peace comes over him. Robinson reappears.
You're gonna be okay, mate, he says.
But the expression on his face says something else.
Doc'll fix you up. You'll see. We'll get you home right quick.
The sun comes out. George hears distorted shouting. More of the guys in his platoon appear. They stand over him, helmets off. Robinson leans down again, close to George's face.
God damn! It's over, George,
Robinson says. The tears on his face running lines through the caked-on dirt.
The war is over. It's fucking armistice.
It is 9:30 a.m., and George Edwin Ellison is dead. The very last British casualty of the First World War. The sun throbs overhead. The rabbit foot, the dream catcher. His luck has run out. And as George's body settles into death, his pupils dilate, becoming two black pools that widen until they consume the whole world. All that is left is darkness. And in that darkness, a small voice screams. 2. 3:33 a.m., November 11, 2018, Marcy Lansing Apartments, Chicago, Illinois. The scream woke Ashanique Walters before she realized it was coming from her own mouth. 2 days ago, she turned 11, and the balloons from her party had deflated and lined her small bedroom floor like dark stones. The door to her bedroom was half open, and out in the living room of her mother's small apartment, she could see the television flickering. An infomercial for a blender ran on mute. White people with cosmetic smiles mugged for the camera as they pretended to enjoy a smoothie that looked like it was dredged from the bottom of Lake Michigan. Ashanique had never felt her heart beat so quickly. A week ago, she'd gone over to a friend's house and played with her pet bunny. With her heart racing, Ashanique remembered how the bunny squirmed when she'd held it. How her friend's mom had told her that if the rabbit got too scared, its heart would beat so fast it would burst. Ashanique's face was slick with sweat, her skin cold despite the blankets, and she worried her heart might burst. Reaching down to adjust her sheets, her fingers came away wet, sticky. Ashanique pulled down her blankets. There was a dark stain on her pajama bottoms between her legs. Blood. She ignored it and climbed out of bed and headed to the pile of books in the corner. There she found a pencil box filled with crayons beneath a tattered hardcover copy of Goodman and Gilman's Manual of Pharmacology and Therapeutics. She carefully peeled the wrappers off the sticks of colored wax and then, in the half light, began drawing on the walls. Ashanique's mother, Janice, found her standing on her bed 13 minutes later. Confused, still half asleep, Janice turned on the lights. Ashanique blinked in the instant brightness as Janice looked over the drawings that covered the walls, even the corners of the ceilings. "Did you see this, baby?" Ashanique nodded. Janice took Ashanique's wax-covered hands and squeezed them. Then, leaning down, she locked eyes with her daughter. Only they weren't the same eyes she'd tucked into bed a few hours earlier. Something had changed. There was a maturity behind them, a knowing that went beyond the girl's years. "Ashanique, everything's going to be okay. That's not my name." Janice took a deep breath and let it out slowly. "What's your name?" "It's George. What's wrong with me?" "Nothing's wrong. Nothing's wrong, baby girl." Janice held Ashanique tight, but Ashanique pulled away.
"I don't want this. I'm scared. I'm scared I don't know who I am."
"Everything will be okay, all right? You have to trust me. I know this is scary. You feel like you're upside down. But this thing that's happening to you in time, you're going to understand it. I'll tell you what I know in the morning about the others. But right now, you know those caterpillars Mrs. Carroll got?"
"Who's Mrs. Carroll? I don't know that person."
Fighting to keep her voice from trembling, Janice ran her fingers along the back of Ashanique's neck and said, "They were ladybug babies, but they didn't look like ladybugs, did they?"
"No.
They looked like little ugly caterpillars with spikes. But then they transform. They curl up and put a little black shell round themselves. They don't know what's happening. You think they decide when the transformation starts? Nah. It's programmed in their blood. It happens when it's time. And when that little black shell opens, what comes out of it?"
"A ladybug comes out."
That's exactly right, Janice said. A beautiful ladybug.
3. 5:16 a.m., November 11, 2018. Marcy Lansing Apartments, Chicago, Illinois. With her daughter passed out in bed, a glass of water and a Tylenol later, Janice sat on the couch with her stopwatch in hand. She tried to calm herself, but her heart was doing its own thing.
Been waiting for this since the girl was born, and now you're going to freak out? Had a decade to get your ass ready, girl.
Don't fall apart now that it's time.
The only art Ashanique ever brought home from school were messes of wet paint and blurry ink stamps. Ashanique's teacher said it wasn't the girl's calling. Mrs. Adams had even joked about maybe a career in medicine, since Ashanique clearly had a doctor's handwriting. But what Ashanique had done was impossible. She transformed her room into a panorama of hell. Using crayons and finger paint, Ashanique had painted smoking ruins of buildings that loomed over crushed bodies and rivers of blood. Horses, their manes on fire, ran across fields of spent bullet casings. Soldiers with machine guns blasted away at faceless crowds. And in one inky corner, near the ceiling, there was a realistic pocket watch with red crayon droplets on its glass face. The time on the watch was 10:55 a.m. The watch appeared broken, and Ashanique had carefully drawn a crude smiley face beside it. Janice had no idea what any of it meant, but she had no doubt about what she'd have to do next. On the couch in front of the flickering TV, Janice started the stopwatch, and then, laying it down on the seat, she reached under the couch to pull out a second-hand laptop from its hiding place. Her hands shook as she opened the laptop. To counter the shaking, she balled her fingers into fists and closed her eyes. Then she gave herself to the count of 10 to calm down. You're in control for once, she thought. This is you in control. Janice opened her eyes and turned the laptop on. It took forever to boot up, and even longer to connect to the neighbor's Wi-Fi. But not because it was a slow machine. It was because Janice had to mask her connection via a series of convoluted encryption programs. When the stopwatch hit 2:36, Janice opened a Tor browser. It was her access to the dark web, the internet's perennial boogeyman, its darkest alleyway, its deepest forest. As with most things, the truth was a lot less sensational. Tor was a tool, and the dark web merely another side street, albeit one largely populated by drug dealers, political dissidents, conspiracy theorists, and jaded degenerates. Janice clicked her way to a website that consisted of nothing more than a black page with a list of dates and what appeared to be military operations. The dates went back to the mid-1980s and continued up until the early 2000s. The operations, things like unconventional warfare and direct action, were marked as carried out and designated with qualifiers like success or failure. Moving the cursor to the left-hand corner of the site, Janice clicked on a tiny star. It opened a new window, a live chat room. She typed, Biogenesis 3. My daughter's null. I need to come in. As Janice waited for a response, she glanced at the stopwatch. Another 40 seconds had passed. Come on. Come on. Then a digital chime sounded. Someone else had entered the chat room. Seattle_undo. Ben Forever 51, how can we trust you? Biogenesis 3. You don't have to. Send someone. Seattle_undo. We'll have to discuss this with Dr. Song. Seattle_undo. Do you have the solution? Myogenesis 3. No, but did you forget who you're talking to? What I've sacrificed? We all moved here,
into the lion's den. Biogenesis 3. It's too early. Just now happened. Seattle_undo. Is your daughter stable? Janice looked up from the laptop at her daughter's room. The door was shut, the apartment dark. Outside, a car screamed around a corner. Dogs barked. The apartment's thin walls did little to keep the sounds out, but they faded quickly. Janice typed. Biogenesis 3. For now. Seattle_undo. We will be in contact when we have asset there. Biogenesis 3. Hurry. You know what this means. Seattle_undo. We know. Janice logged out. The stopwatch hit 4 minutes. She powered down the laptop and then slid it carefully back under the couch before she headed to the bathroom. There, in the brutal glare of an unshielded light bulb, Janice studied her face. Her brown skin was chapped, cheeks sallow, and her eyes deeply bloodshot. It was nearly 5:30 in the morning, but the haggard look on her face wasn't from exhaustion or worry. It's getting worse, Janice thought. Only a few years before Dr. Song's gonna have to sleep me like the others. Wonder what that's like, living in a dream like some fairy tale princess, until Prince Science comes along to fix you. For a moment, just between heartbeats, Janice saw a man reflected in the mirror. He was tall and white. His head was shaved and he wore a salt and pepper beard. Janice could see a scar on his forehead. His aquiline nose had been broken sometime in the past, and it bent slightly to the right. Janice closed her eyes and took a deep breath. When she opened them, the man was gone. Janice pulled out a medicine pack from the cabinet over the sink. Then she punched 2 yellow and white capsules stamped Metrochime from their protective silver blisters and popped them into her mouth. She'd been taking these drugs for 17 years, and they went down easy. Drugs on board, she crouched and reached behind the toilet and pulled out a plastic bag bound with duct tape to the underside of the toilet bowl. Inside was a Glock 17 9mm. Janice ejected the magazine, counted the bullets, and then reloaded it, all in one smooth motion. 9 seconds. You're getting rusty, girl. Rusty. Worn. Built to degrade. Staring down at the gun in her hand, Janice considered what it would be like when the capsule stopped working, when Dr. Song gave her that permanent IV and put her adrift into her own mental abyss. Before she even knew what she was doing, Janice put the muzzle of the Glock in her mouth. It tasted like old silverware. She imagined the contents of her head splattering Pollock style on the green tile of the bathroom floor. But the thought passed quickly. If nothing worked, if the voices got to be too loud, if Ashanik was lost or Dr. Song found, there would be time enough to end it quickly. Always disappointed in her pessimism, Janice forced herself to be positive. You're acting a fool. Let the medicine work. Let it do its job. Janice told herself, Ashanik has the solution. You know in your heart of hearts that she does. Janice took the gun from her mouth and wiped her lips. It's so early. You're just stressed and losing your cool. Can't lose your cool. Can't ever lose it like that again. Janice stood and tucked the Glock into the waistband of her sweats. Looking back at her reflection, she flashed a toothy smile. Let's go, 51. You can do this. 4. 11:43 a.m., November 13, 2018. University of Chicago, Chicago, Illinois. The lecture hall was full. Looking out over the faces of the 200-plus undergrads scribbling in their notebooks, Matilda recognized only a handful. They were 2 months into the semester, and most of the kids hadn't yet attended a lecture. But they were certainly there for hers. Of course they are, Matilda thought. She knew the reality of it. The undergrads weren't there for her speaking skills
or even to hear her hypotheses.
Matilda wasn't like her mentor, Dr. Clark Liptak. She could never push away the lectern and wade up into the seats like a rock star.
No, the co-eds weren't crowding the seats to catch a glimpse of the department's hottest professor, or be razzle-dazzled by academic speak. They didn't want to hear her lecture on the atomic correlate of memory or synaptic plasticity. They were sitting in the half-light, sharpened pencils at the ready, recording apps open on their phones, because of the topic. It was the message that brought them, hardly the messenger.
How many people in this room believe in life after death?
Half the hands went up.
Matilda had done this lecture 15 times in the preceding 2 years,
and every time the number of students who believed in the hereafter decreased.
Guess what, Maddie?
Another 5 lectures, and it'll just be the homeschooled kids at the front of the hall with their hands up.
Ghosts?
Half the hands stayed raised, the biggest showing she'd seen. Most of the undergrads, Matilda found, rejected their parents' cloud and sunshine heaven, but went whole hog on ghosts. She chalked that up to pop culture. All the ghost hunter reality shows, the now near ubiquity of Halloween. If she were a sociologist, she'd have called it trading one fable for another.
How about reincarnation?
The rebirth of the soul in a different body? Only 6 kids kept their hands up.
Well, today we're going to talk about past lives,
Matilda dived in.
About what that term means, why we want to believe in past life regression therapy, and the pitfalls of hypnotism.
Matilda dimmed the lights and put up the first slide. It was a droll New Yorker cartoon she'd inherited from her undergrad advisor, a badly cropped and overpixelated image of 2 men sitting at a desk across from each other. The bubble over one guy read,
"I'm here to learn more about reincarnation."
The other guy's bubble read, "Welcome back." The slide got a few chuckles.
"Belief in reincarnation is as old as civilization itself. Even though my esteemed colleagues in the physics department 2 doors over tell me that time doesn't actually exist, everything we do is dependent on it. We are creatures of time, locked into seasons, driven by cycles. The clock rules everything we do, from the minute we're born to that final second before we die. As humans, we're always looking to rise above nature, bust out of our earthly bonds, to break the stranglehold time has over us. That be the ultimate." The room was silent, focused. The undergrads weren't scribbling in their notepads. They were leaning forward, breathing slowed, fixated. Everyone, from the freshman with the broken leg to the sophomore with the pierced eyebrows, was tractor-beamed on slides, ratcheted in on Matilda's voice. Unlike early American English literature, where they had to dissect a poem by a recluse holed up by an algae-choked pond, this was the kind of lecture the students were happy their parents were paying for. Another slide flashed on the screen. New Age artwork of an oak tree spinning in outer space. Cheese ball, Matilda thought, but effective. The idea that we're not the end of a line, but a continuum, is a universal one. Every human culture throughout history has built itself on the foundations of the cultures that came before it. Civilizations just don't spring up ex nihilo out of nothing. They are carried forward. They are built with our grandfathers and grandmothers' bricks. That's poetic, but you get what I mean. We are nothing without our pasts. The next slide popped up. In it, a 1950s-styled woman reclined on a couch. She had black hair, cut short, and her eyes were closed, but she wasn't asleep. She'd been hypnotized. Matilda said, "This is Virginia, a housewife from just down the road. In the mid-50s, she began recalling the past life of a 19th-century Irish woman named Bridie Murphy. Her case was one of the very first modern past life cases. It's a benchmark, one that came to define thousands and thousands of others,
And yes, she is hypnotized in this picture. The slides continue to click by. Photo after photo, face after face. Normal people. Old and young, black and white. Matilda scrolled through their stories as she rattled off their names. This woman recalled a past life as the Pharaoh's daughter. This man was the reincarnation of a decorated World War II fighter pilot. She was once a general in the war between the states. All of them recalled the lives of people they could not possibly have been related to. You'll be surprised to learn they all shared one thing in common: a therapist. A therapist, consciously or more often unconsciously, caught up in his or her patient's stories. There was an audible sigh from the audience. Already, she was letting them down. But, of course, it's not just that the therapist is primed to find past lives in a subject. Turns out, people who most often claim to have past life memories also believe in reincarnation. They want the memories. They want to feel as though there is something bigger than themselves, that they are more important than just a sales clerk or a lawyer. She went on, slide after slide, point after point. Matilda never lost sight of her goal. These undergrads weren't going to walk away well-versed about the Bloxham tapes or with deep knowledge in neurolinguistic programming, but they would become better critical thinkers. Matilda's job, the real reason she was standing at the podium, was to shake these kids' foundations just enough to ensure they walked out of the room a little dazed. And she was feeling it. She was in the zone, on track to have her best lecture yet. Until the door at the back of the hall opened, and Clark slipped inside. God damn it. He stood against the wall, hands folded neatly behind his back. Matilda noticed he was wearing the suit she made the mistake of telling him he looked really sexy in. She knew it would never come off after that. Her mistake. He was even growing out his beard. She had to admit it looked good, and added to his already distinguished late 40s, in his academic prime air. The same air that had attracted her to him 18 months ago. That's why, Matilda continued, distracted. We often find that the past lives people claim to recall are typically grandiose. No one wants to have the past life memories of a Russian peasant or a Neolithic hunter. They want the memories of kings and queens. Of powerful people, respected people they would rather be like. Who would you rather have a conversation with? The ghost of Einstein, or the sad specter of some failed businessman?
If it was real.
Matilda looked up to see one of her sophomores, the boy from Wisconsin who stayed late after every class with reams of questions, the same one always looking to poke holes in her theories. He stood and finished.
And what would that mean for your chemistry research? If there's evidence of some sort of afterlife, then maybe memory isn't a biochemical thing. Maybe it's a spiritual thing. And that's why people remember past lives. You know, like people have been kind of saying for thousands and thousands of years.
And just like that, Matilda was thrown off. It actually wasn't because of the Wisconsin kid's question. Really, it was more of an emotivistic statement, or his overconfident tone. It was the memory that flashed into Matilda's head. The memory she never realized she'd had. For a split second, Matilda saw her mother Lucy in the kitchen putting the finishing touches on a BLT stacked high with bacon and heirloom tomatoes. Matilda had been in high school at the time, and Lucy was showing the first signs of the neural degeneration that would slowly take her mind apart, brain cell by brain cell. In her memory, Matilda sat on the kitchen counter, putting the utensils Lucy handed her into the sink. Lucy laughed to herself and said, staring down at the sandwiches, "What if one day scientists prove that being spiritual is just another mental illness? What if they make a pill to treat it?" The comment came out of the blue. Lucy hadn't attended church since she was six and lived in Iowa.
Matilda asked her mother what she meant, but Lucy just shook her head and suggested she was just getting old. She was 43 at the time. Flashing back to the classroom, Matilda stared out at her students but didn't see them. She pulled a post-it note from her purse and scribbled a few shorthand notes about the memory. As she did this, she distractedly tried to wrap up the lecture. I think that question is not worth answering, actually. It presupposes that this is a... Okay, listen. I have sat in on hundreds of past life regression therapy sessions. I've personally done in-depth interviews with 75 people who claim to have vivid memories from a past life. I have yet to see a convincing case. Regardless of mechanism, be it spiritual or chemical, the fact remains that our memories end when we end. Tucking the post-it into her purse, Matilda looked up to see Clark wink. 5. An electronic chime broke the tension. The students were up and out of their seats and choking the stairs before Matilda had time to mention that the next week they'd be discussing operant conditioning. She pulled her hair back in a ponytail. 2 weeks ago, she dyed it blue. The class got a kick out of seeing it, and her graduate students seemed to think it spoke to her rebellious nature inside the institution. They considered Matilda that professor, the one willing to rock the boat and contemplate outsider ideas. Well, they'd find out soon enough that when it came to science, she was as much a traditionalist as the others. She just did things with a little more color, a little more verve. As Matilda gathered up her papers, Clark walked over and pecked her cheek. That's new, she thought. He must want something. So, how was it? Tell me honestly.
Good, Clark said. You have their attention, that's clear.
I threw in the Barnum effect thing last minute. Not sure it added much.
It didn't.
Barely hiding her frustration, Matilda stuffed her papers in her messenger bag. They went in wonky and got caught in the zipper, but she didn't have the patience to sort them out. Clark got the hint. Thinking he knew exactly what to say, he leaned in and whispered,
"You look stunning."
That's great, but I'm actually going for professional.
You're young. Professional is dull. Come on.
Clark put his hand on Matilda's shoulder, gave it a soft squeeze. They'd been having sex for 10 months. It began the way these sort of affairs always did, with naivete traipsing into the darkened woods of hedonism. She'd caught Clark's eye during one of his infamous subjective validation lectures, infamous because he'd always end them with a demonstration. A sacrifice. He'd pull some poor grad student up on stage and break them down, tear apart all their core beliefs, leave them psychologically shrunken and traumatized. The audience ate it up. And after the psychological bruising had worn off, the victim always became a true believer. Always. A week after the lecture, Matilda stopped by Clark's office in a skirt shorter than she normally wore, with her hair up, and asked him about a 1998 paper he'd written on the dark triad of Machiavellianism, psychopathy, and narcissism. His eyes wandered. She was there to impress. It worked. 40 weeks, 2 weekend getaways, and 6 crying jags later, here they were, the most open secret in the psychology department. The sex was good, but his lies were terrible. It amazed her that a man so practiced in how the mind works wouldn't be able to juggle his own deceptions. Matilda hated being the other woman, hated the hot swell of shame she felt when she caught a glance at the family photos on Clark's desk. No matter how lifeless, how unloving his marriage was, and he insisted it was at the organ donation stage, the idea that she was breaking something, even something already broken, was unsettling. Still, she'd never felt so enjoyed before. For Clark, this affair with Matilda was like the first full meal he'd had in years. As they stepped out of the lecture hall into the teeming hallways, Clark scratched at his chin. It was a familiar, nervous effect, one of his blatant tells for when he shifted into passive-aggressive mode. his worst mode.
So, I got a call yesterday. I'd love for you to check out this afternoon.
Let me guess. A parent calling about their daughter? Clark said.
Yes, but not what you're thinking.
I'm thinking she experimented with shrooms, had a nasty trip, wound up in a psych hold over at UC Med, and her father is threatening to sue. Dean Gilovich wants you to mediate. Do some of your patented angry parent whispering?
Clark laughed and touched her hip.
That's my sexy hate machine.
Matilda pushed his hand away.
Yuck!
You know I hate that. Clark apologized as they stopped at an elevator bank.
Look,
he said, his voice a lower register to not so subtly communicate his displeasure at being reprimanded.
This is outside the U. It's a favor for a friend. And, yes, by friend, I mean someone who's given very liberally to the campus, and our program in particular.
So, another nut job?
I thought you were going for professional. The girl was in a car accident. She wasn't drunk or anything. She's a good kid. Got knocked out. Concussion. The works. And woke up recalling her time aboard a merchant marine vessel at Incheon.
You know traumatic brain injury stuff is unreliable. I can't do anything with a case like that, Clark.
Please. Just see her. For me.
I still haven't gotten through last quarter's Gardner essays. There's that proposal for the APA, and Teresa and I are still crunching numbers on the assisted living study. Todd and I are heading over to the Marcy Lansing apartments this afternoon, and that always leads to... Anyway, just feels like every free hour between here and March is well accounted for. The empty elevator arrived, and as they stepped inside, Clark pulled Matilda close and crushed his lips against hers. She melted, even with his newly emboldened whiskers tickling her cheek and his left hand clenching her ass.
First off, Clark said, as he let her go and adjusted his tie, it'd be doing me a huge favor. I have back-to-back meetings all week. Then there's the whole Aspen deal on Saturday, and I was hoping to get a few runs in. Second, and most important.
So it should have been first.
I was building the dramatic tension. Anyway, despite your poo-pooing, it's right up your alley. You need more structural stuff in your work. Turn that chemist side of your brain loose on it. How about tomorrow morning we meet up early? I'll bring coffee and donuts. We'll meet at your office and I'll tell you everything there is to know. Then you can decide, but I think you'll love it.
The elevator stopped. The door slid open. Matilda stepped out, but Clark stayed inside, hands holding the doors open.
You know, he said, you shouldn't be too harsh on the spiritual kids. I've often found that at the end of the day, we all end up hoping for something more than just this life. If I were to die tomorrow, you bet I'd be spending my last conscious moments praying there's a heaven. Or thinking of your great ass.
With that, Clark let the elevator doors close. The last image Matilda had of him was a blurry grin. 6. Matilda's office was a shrine to memory. Though it was small, exactly 10 feet by 15 feet, and she had measured it several times, it was packed tight with all her thoughts. It was a heavy oak bookcase, stuffed with psychology volumes, notebooks, and bound journals, most of which she'd inherited from her predecessor, a tenured professor who shared a love for the smell of old books. Even though Matilda hadn't thumbed through half the hand-me-downs, she frequently sat in her office and gazed at them. Bookshelves were little shrines to knowledge, her mother used to say. She assumed with some certainty that the bibliophile in her was a direct product of her genetics. The one and only fact Matilda truly knew about her father, or drive-by sperm donor, as Lucy called him, was that he collected first edition, signed, hardcover books. But it wasn't the books that people who stopped by Matilda's office noticed first. It was the walls,
or rather what was covering them. Post-it notes, file cards, and scraps of paper. They made the walls look like they were growing multicolored bark. And all that paper went at least half an inch deep. It was so thick and ubiquitous that Matilda worried about the structural integrity of the room. Cutting a chunk out of one of the walls and viewing it sideways would provide a cross-section of Matilda's mind. She'd been in the office 2 years, and each stratum of paper would reveal a different aspect of her work, from her first proposals to lab setup, to experiments and data collection. The very bottom layer would reflect her initial thoughts on the chemistry of memory. That was Matilda's true passion, the core of her drive. She wanted to find the neurochemical pathway that explained how memories were made and stored, and she would not stop adding to the walls until she did. Despite the appearance of the office, Matilda was not messy. She was a fastidious thinker. Her mother used to say she never met an idea she couldn't categorize, and almost threatened to have the saying which she'd coined crocheted and framed. Matilda tacked the note about Lucy up on the wall, just over her desk. Then, after shaking off her frustration with Clark, she let out a deep sigh and settled down into her well-worn desk chair. Mentally running through the rest of her day, Matilda let her eyes rove across the walls before settling on an organic molecule drawn on lined paper. It was glutamate, the most common neurotransmitter in the brain. The shape of it resembled a fish. One of Matilda's juniors drew it for her a few months earlier. He was very nervous when he handed it to her. A big chemistry nerd with a crush on his prof. It was the only sort of love letter he could craft. And, of course, she adored it. Glutamate. Matilda liked how the word had a distinctive onomatopoeic resonance. To her, it sounded like someone chewing gum. Glutamate. Glue. Latin for sticky stuff. And ate, meaning from a salty acid. As Matilda turned the word over in her mind, she remembered why she found it so curious. Her grandfather Norbert used to mumble something similar.
Gläubio. Gläubnit,
he'd say.
Gläubio. Gläubnit.
And just like that, Matilda was six again, and climbing the narrow stairs in her mom's old house to the second floor. In her memories, it was always autumn. The light was diffuse and the stairs creaked. Grandpa Norbert's room was at the end of the hall, just past the tiny green-tiled bathroom. Matilda's mother's father had moved into their house when she was three. All she knew about Grandpa Norbert was that he was from a faraway country where they didn't speak English. His wife had died in a war. He didn't seem to like children, and he only ever came out of the bedroom to use the bathroom and stare down at her like a shadowy statue from the top of the stairs. Matilda was thankful her bedroom was on the ground floor beside her mother's. Unlike most of her school friends, she was not scared of the basement. It was the upper story that hid a potential monster. In Matilda's memory, Grandpa Norbert's door was open a crack, and she was desperate to peek inside. She had only ever seen inside Grandpa Norbert's room once, just a few weeks earlier when her mom was sick and asked her to bring him some hot tea. Then Grandpa Norbert had been in bed, a lump, snoring beneath rough blankets. Matilda placed the tea on his dresser, and when he coughed, clearing his throat like something at the Chicago Zoo's big cat exhibit, she ran. A timid child, Matilda had recently learned to be scared of three new things: thunderstorms, spiders, and jaguars. Jaguars were the worst. Her school friend Annie had terrified her at recess with a story about a jaguar dragging a Brazilian woman from her bed.
And, Annie delighted in saying, they only ever found her feet.
Matilda approached her grandfather's door very slowly, cautiously, and peeked inside. She saw his bed, the rough blankets in a scrambled pile, the dresser, and most disturbing, his worn and muddy leather shoes. Just as she was opening the door farther to look at the closet, Matilda heard the toilet flush in the green-tiled bathroom. Her heart nearly exploding, Matilda raced into Grandpa Norbert's room and slipped underneath his twin bed. It wasn't until she'd pushed herself up against the wall, her clothes covered in dust and cobwebs, that she realized the mistake she'd made. She should have turned and run downstairs. If she had been fast, and she was a very fast runner, she could have passed him in a blur. Now she was trapped.
Matilda watched through a narrow rectangle of light under the bed as Grandpa Norbert shuffled into the room. She could see his bare feet, toenails thick and yellowed by fungus, and veins snaking around his joints like thick worms. Grandpa Norbert mumbled to himself,
"Mumse, but hoch schonen, zost lingen intred, fieschit lapschun nauschi."
Matilda heard him go through a paper bag. She cringed when he dropped a black skeleton key on the floor. It was one he wore on a string around his neck. Mom told Matilda it was for the closet in the bedroom. She wondered what he kept in there.
The bones of children? A jaguar he'd smuggled from the zoo?
Possibly. Brauchst du dein Leben, hoch Mas Thorsten?
Matilda held her breath as Grandpa Norbert's gnarled hand appeared and snatched up the fallen key. She could see numbers tattooed on his forearm in faded ink. They reminded her of spider's legs. Matilda exhaled slowly as he crossed the room and unlocked the closet door. She had to remain calm. From her vantage point, Matilda could see the closet was filled with canned food. Stacked neatly, can upon can, it created an aluminum wall that reached up to the ceiling. There was no obvious organization to the cans. Peas sat on clams. Yams were tucked in beside peaches. As he stood there looking in, Grandpa Norbert spun several of the cans around to better see their labels. He continued to mumble. Matilda was fascinated by the cans. Mrs. Cartwright, her first grade teacher, once told her that she should bring an extra snack to school, one to put in her desk for a rainy day. Matilda wondered what rainy day Grandpa Norbert was waiting for. Maybe it will be a flood.
100 hazard solar hoven. In jeder Haus 100 Zimmern. In jeder Zimmer 20. Pull shaken. Wort Maya Visitka.
Mom told Matilda that Grandpa Norbert's talk was his own language. It wasn't what he used to speak where he came from. It wasn't what his wife who died spoke. Mom said it was mostly Yiddish, some Russian, and a lot of it made up. Regardless of what it was, it sounded scary. Grandpa Norbert closed the door, and Matilda listened intently as he locked it. Then she heard the bedroom door open and then close. She moved to get a better angle but couldn't see Grandpa Norbert's feet anymore. Carefully, sliding on her belly like a seal across the Antarctic ice pack, Matilda emerged, and Grandpa Norbert was standing right there, just off to the side of the bed by the dresser. He had tricked her. Matilda wanted to scream but couldn't. Grandpa Norbert's face reminded Matilda of a wild animal. The kind that rampaged through a forest, howling as it ran. His eyebrows were bushy and unkempt, explosions of hair that overhung, deep-set, glacier blue eyes. His lips were hidden behind a scraggly beard.
Hitzig, du hast sich schon einmal aufgeregt.
I'm sorry, Grandpa,
Matilda stuttered, backing away.
I didn't mean.
Matilda turned to run, but Grandpa Norbert grabbed her and placed something in her hand. When she finally wrenched herself free, she ran downstairs and didn't stop running until she was safely outside, in the small backyard, beneath the sweeping hair of the dying weeping willow. After she'd caught her breath, she opened her hand to see what Grandpa Norbert had placed there. It was a black, polished river stone. She cried looking at the stone, and cried when Lucy came home and made her go up to Grandpa Norbert and apologize. Grandpa Norbert was taken to the hospital for an ulcer 2 weeks later and died 24 hours after he was admitted. Matilda never learned where the stone had come from or why her grandfather had given it to her, but she kept it on her desk throughout school. She knew it was buried somewhere beneath her papers on her desk. She leaned forward to look for it when she was startled by a knock at the door.
Todd Garcia Arreaz stuck his head in. He was a 30-year-old assistant professor of psychology from Baltimore. Tall and chubby, with a mop of red hair, Todd loved the clinical aspects of his job. And, unlike Matilda, he found endless satisfaction in promoting talk therapy. Real talk therapy, as he liked to call it. Old school. Todd even had his office decked out with a leather armchair, the type 19th-century therapists had in their book-lined bureaus. And plants. He had a lot of plants.
You ready to go?
Yeah, Matilda said.
Just give me a minute.
Okay. I'll be outside warming up the bride. Todd closed the door. Matilda dug around her desk for the stone. She found it under a stack of newsletters. She touched it to her cheek. It was warm. 7. 2:29 p.m., November 13, 2018. Marcy Lansing Apartments, Chicago, Illinois. Clouds threatening rain hung low as Todd's Volvo station wagon pulled into the parking lot outside the Marcy Lansing Apartments. He killed the engine and grabbed a file folder from his backpack. Flipping through the pages, he read off the visits for the day.
Following up on the self-harm thoughts that Tanisha told us about, there's Shayna and Derek too. We really need to talk to their aunt about some of the abuse stuff. Would be good to fill them in.
We ever hear back from Chicago Welfare on Jameer? Matilda asked. Todd looked over his notes.
Still waiting.
Matilda turned to the apartment building. Its gray, hulking bulk sat low in the late afternoon shadows. She scanned the floors, eyes falling over boarded-up windows, and the telltale charcoal marks where past fires had licked the bricks. The apartments were built in the mid-1970s. Perhaps back then its builders saw great things ahead, like ambitious futures for the residents they hoped to pull out of poverty. As well-intentioned as they were also very wrong. For the vast majority of the 2,000 people who called Marcy Lansing home, it was yet another ghetto to escape. Only this one went up instead of out.
You ready? Todd asked.
Yeah. Let's go do some good. As they made their way inside, Matilda and Todd passed a huddle of young boys milling around the entrance. Tight denim black ball caps and puffy coats. The boys, none of them older than 15, smoked cigarettes, cursed, and laughed loudly. The tallest of them, with a knit cap and freckles, stepped in front of Todd.
Where you think you going, bro?
We're from the university, Todd said. We're here to visit a few people.
What people? What people?
One of the boys parroted.
You all doctors or something?
Yes, Matilda said. The boy with the cap looked her up and down.
Maybe I need a physical.
A few of the other boys laughed, gave high fives. Cap stepped up to Matilda. His head cocked to the side. He stared at her, hard. His smile revealed the glint of his gold fronts. He was close enough that Matilda could smell the menthol cigarette on his breath. Instead of shying away, she stepped even closer, inches from his face.
What's your name?
Huh? Cap asked.
What's your name? Matilda said again. Shit.
Cap stepped back, looked over to his friends to read their faces. They were transfixed. No help.
Why you want to know?
I think I know you, Matilda said, reading the micro-expressions dancing across Cap's face. He was compressing his lips, squinting, very nervous.
Your mom's Rainice, right?
Matilda continued.
Yeah, so?
So? She asked me to talk to you. Said she's worried about you. You're having trouble sleeping. You should talk to me about it. I can help. Cap blinked rapidly as he ground his teeth. Tight as a coil, tension hung in the air.
Ha 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 ha!
Cap laughed, breaking the moment.
I'm just playing with you, lady.
He stepped aside and let Todd and Matilda pass. Matilda nodded to him. Seriously, if you need help, I'm here.
Nah, I'm good. I'm real good.
As Cap and his friends laughed and tossed their cigarettes, Todd and Matilda traversed the small apartment lobby to a graffiti-festooned elevator.
You handle that well,
Todd said after the elevator doors had closed. They're just kids.
I've seen just kids beat a man unconscious for his shoes.
At the 9th floor, they navigated a narrow series of hallways lined with doors to apartments. Most had new locks installed, and there were trash bags sitting outside half the doors. As they walked, Matilda looked over at a box of old toys by one door. In and among the ratty stuffed animals and broken electronics were Barbie dolls that had been colored with markers to make their skin black. Matilda and Todd stopped at a door near the end of the hall. They caught their breath before knocking. The day's first case would be a rough one. Behind the door was a 13-year-old heroin addict. The kid had tried to stay clean, but his father was in jail and his mother's boyfriend routinely assaulted him. During their first meeting, the boy told Todd and Matilda he had no future, that no one listened to his worries, his fears, or his dreams. Matilda noted dozens of cuts on his arms from where he dragged a naked razor blade across his flesh.
Ready?
Let's go.
8. 4:32 p.m., November 13, 2018. Northgate Mall, Seattle, Washington. Gabby DeLaconde was hearing the voices again. They told her that this was it.
This is what you've spent the last 18 years waiting for.
Gabby zigzagged through the crowds of shoppers. Their clothes were still beaded with raindrops, and the smell of their perfume and cologne and hairspray and breath mints was nearly overwhelming. Gabby had to stop by the food court to dry heave into a trash can. As she caught her breath and wiped saliva from her lips, she noticed a boy no older than 8 staring at her over his lunch. A little boy with freckled cheeks and olive pit-colored eyes. Just like,
Mommy,
the boy said, his mouth half-filled with pizza crust.
What's wrong with that woman over there?
The boy's mother, a pretty woman who looked existentially exhausted, refocused her son on his food.
It's not nice to stare, she said.
Gabby didn't want to think about the freckled boy she knew. The one they damaged so badly he had to be kept in a cage like an animal. Gabby closed her eyes and pushed away the worst of the memories.
Focus, the voices told her. Today is the day.
Riding the escalator to the second floor, Gabby noticed the big toenail on her left foot, thick, curved with fungus, was sticking out through the unstitched leather of her falling apart flats. The voices didn't even need to tell her she was losing it. She already knew. But if there was anything she prided herself on, it was being tough. Tough in the way Father Broderick at the All Saints Orphanage taught her to be. She knew the dictums. You never fall, you roll. You don't take a punch, you slide into it. Illness is only an opportunity to improve your immune system. Loss makes for a cleaner house.
Being so desperately poor that your shoes are falling apart on your feet?
She asked herself.
Yes, that's true commitment. This is because I am the cause. I am the reason we're still alive. The reason we've gotten to this moment.
And yeah, she had to sacrifice her dignity. Numerous times. She had to put up with an unbearable amount of scorn and hate and shit. She knew that anyone in her situation would go a little crazy. It had been 15 years. Or was it 17? Gabby couldn't recall the last time she'd slept in a bed with clean sheets. Upstairs, Gabby found her Mark examining suits at Macy's. He was a businessman with unnaturally tanned skin and marbled hair that was crisp with gel. Judging by the coat haphazardly slung over his shoulder and the fact that one of his loafers was untied, Gabby knew he'd be easy, and so she moved quickly, weaving through a crowd of loud teenagers before bumping into the businessman hard enough to knock him off balance. He turned to her, ready to shout, but choked on any ounce of ambitious rage he might have had when he saw her face. The disheveled, filthy look got them every time.
"I'm sorry," the businessman said. "You okay?"
He didn't hang around for an answer. Instead, pulling his coat tight to his chest, he melted into the passing crowd. Gabby made her way toward the dressing room with a businessman's cell phone, a Samsung with a large touch screen that had been clearly shattered and replaced several times. But that didn't matter, at least not for what Gabby intended. As she walked, Gabby took the phone apart with a sure hand and near-military efficiency. She dropped the stuff she'd sell later in the left pocket of her coat. The rest, the GSM antenna, the Wi-Fi adapter, she slid into her right. Impressively, the cell was cannibalized within 52 seconds. Gabby would make a few bucks from the parts, but it was the SIM card she was after, the access to a working line. Stepping into a dressing room, Gabby locked the door and settled onto the tiny stool tucked into one corner of the room. The mirror was streaked, and Gabby avoided catching a glimpse of herself in it. She didn't want to know how matted her hair was, how dusky her skin had gotten. In the immediate silence, without the crush of passing voices, in the atmospherics of air recycled through endless vents, the voices came back, chanting their simple chorus.
"Look, Gabby. Look at what you've become."
Gabby pushed the voices away and pulled an indented Metro Chime capsule from her pocket. She chewed it between her left molars, the good ones, before she got to work on the Raspberry Pi phone in her purse. It was a smart design, a hand-built smartphone with a touchscreen. A little clumsy, sure. Some of the soldering was rather ugly, and the 3D-printed case she made at the library didn't exactly snap on tight. But it worked, and it was untraceable. Gabby slid the stolen SIM card into her DIY phone. It took a second to come online. As it did, the voices hummed in the background. Gabby pushed her big toe back into her shoe and considered shoplifting a pair of sneakers on her way out. Seconds later, the phone was ready, the SIM card active. Gabby had only one phone number memorized. She dialed. Two rings later, a woman's voice answered, distorted by disguising tech.
"Yes?
It's Gabby. You got the message about 51?
Yes?"
Gabby cleared her throat and pulled up her coat sleeve. She had three watches on her left wrist, all displayed the exact same time. She tracked closely as the seconds clicked by.
"They need a route to Dr. Song," she said into her cell. "Contact Dirk. He can send Childers. You do know what this means, right? This is it. This is what we've been waiting so long for."
"Of course."
"Excellent."
Hearing someone moving down the narrow aisle just outside her dressing room door, Gabby ended the call. Then she leaned down to peek through the 2-foot gap at the bottom of the door. Seeing nothing, Gabby took the Raspberry Pi phone apart. She slammed the screen against the wall and cracked the SIM card in half.
"Done," the voices said. "Told you this was the day."
And that was exactly when a head appeared in the gap under the door. A man's head, bald with no facial hair, not even eyebrows. Gabby recoiled, her adrenaline kicking in before the terror did. The baby-faced man held a gun in his right hand and aimed it at Gabby's chest as he smoothly pulled himself through the gap under the door. As her hand started to shake, Gabby was struck by how easily the man could torque and stretch himself like a gymnast. She was dumbstruck even further to see how tall and thin he was when, fully inside the changing room, he towered over her. The man wore a hoodie, athletic sweatpants with reflective stripes, and latex gloves.
"This is the devil," the voices in her head said. "Come to get you, Gabby."
"Where's 51?
The man asked. Gabby could hardly speak. Her throat was so dry, collapsing in on itself.
"Where is 51?
I don't know.
Gun still leveled on Gabby's chest, The man reached into his jacket pocket and pulled out a syringe filled with clear liquid. As the man bit the safety lid off the top of the syringe, the voices chanted,
"He's the devil. Devil come to get you. Where is 51?
The man asked again.
"I'm telling you the truth. I don't know," Gabby said. "I haven't seen her in decades. You have to believe me."
"He'll take your heart. He'll take your eyes."
The man moved quicker than Gabby expected. In the space between heartbeats, he shoved the gun into her gut, pressed his left forearm up against her throat, and forced her back against the mirror. With the throat pinched, Gabby felt faint. She couldn't push the man off. Her hand scrambled across his hoodie, her nails searching desperately for any exposed skin they could sink into.
"You're going to have a heart attack," the man said. "It'll be caused by a coronary spasm. One of the arteries that feeds blood into your heart is going to clamp down, real tight. It will be painful. Feel like someone just hit you in the chest with a sledgehammer. But you'll die within seconds. He'll take your heart."
Gabby gasped, her vision blurred, and the world spun around her. For the first time in 15 years, she was happy to hear the voices.
"You're going to be okay," they told her,
as they repeated Father Broderick's favorite saying,
"Every end is a new beginning."
As her body went limp, the man took the syringe and stuck the needle into the soft red corner of Gabby's right eye. Then he calmly depressed the plunger. The clear liquid burned as it went in. Gabby's sinuses were suddenly on fire, and even as weak as she was at that moment, she bucked and kicked.
"Good," the man said. "Fight it. Fight it."
Gabby fought, and that was when the real pain hit. Her body racked by a tsunami of ragged nerves. The wave of agony washed over her and stole the very breath from her lungs. Gabby's eyes went wide as she spasmed once and heard her incisors break as her jaw clamped down too tight. The man let Gabby fall to the floor of the dressing room. Lying there, a final spasm shook her limp body before she was still. In her last milliseconds of existence, the voices, the ones that had taunted and cajoled her for half her life, suddenly fell silent. Gabby's oxygen-starved brain did the only thing it could think to do. It scrolled back through images, searching desperately for the few moments when she was happy. It found sunshine, a beach, a welcome hand. Raid cracked his neck, peeled off his latex gloves, and then emerged from the dressing room, closing the door carefully behind him. On his way onto the Macy's, he folded his gloves carefully before sliding them in a pocket of his hoodie. 5 minutes later, Raid was hot-wiring a black SUV in the mall's parking garage when a Latino man with a ponytail noticed him.
"Yo, the fuck you doing?"
Raid sat up and looked the man over.
"That your car, man? Don't look like your car."
As Raid stepped out of the car, Ponytail stepped closer to look into the SUV's interior. Raid's tools were laid out on the front passenger seat in a roll-up leather case. It was the kind of kit a professional thief carried around.
"Oh, hell no. Can't let you do that."
But Ponytail stopped short when Raid dragged a box cutter blade across the softest part of his throat, just above the Adam's apple. The wound was barely visible, like a long pink paper cut, before the blood welled up, bubbling out. It happened so fast, Ponytail had no final movements, no noise, just wide-eyed horrible shock. Ponytail crumbled at Raid's feet. Pocketing the box cutter, Raid got on his cell, and as his call rang through, reached into the SUV to gather his tools. A deep-voiced man answered,
"Talk to me. Northgate Mall. I need all camera feeds wide from 4:15 to 5, and I've got collateral disposal on the 5th floor of the parking garage.
What about 51?
Raid crossed the garage to another SUV.
22 wouldn't talk, But she did make a call on a burner cell. Home construction. Must have snagged a sim off someone. Possibly someone in the mall. We need to look at police reports. Someone calling in about a lost cell. We trace the calls made with his sim card, and we move forward. Dr. Sykes asked that you be more careful, Raid.
More careful how?
You're not a Viking. This isn't a slaughterhouse. Make them cleaner. We can't have questions. You already know all this.
Raid hung up the cell and slid it into his pants. Then he pulled a code grabber from a hoodie pocket to read the SUV's remote keyless entry signal. It took two tries, but the doors to the SUV unlocked. Raid climbed inside, unrolled his hot wiring kit, and got to work. 56 seconds later, the SUV's engine roared to life.